Now, back to Hancock and Kelly, sponsored by Insperity, HR that makes a difference, on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
Yesterday, one of the things that was most stark and memorable for me, John, as it related to the D-Day celebration, there was one of the D-Day veterans who, as you indicated earlier, almost all 100 years old.
Right.
They had 40 or 50 of them behind President Macron and President Biden there. But there was one in particular, an American, who was greeting President Zelensky. And he recognized him and said, "Hey, you're the man who's saving the world." And Zelensky took a second to process what he said. And he said, "No, you're saving the world." And Zelensky said, "No, sir, you saved Europe." But it was a really touching moment that here was this man who literally did go and save the world as a young man, meeting somebody who's essentially the Dwight Eisenhower, if you will, or the Winston Churchill of his moment his school, in terms of you know, standing up. And it was a special moment. I don't know if you saw it.
I did. And, you know, Zelensky, whatever you may think of him, has people, when Russia invaded over 2 years ago, the prevailing wisdom was that it was going to be a matter of weeks and Russia was going to march into Kyiv and they were going to take over the country. They were going to kill Zelensky. We offered to fly Zelensky in exile at the time,
right,
you'll remember. And rather, he stood his ground and he said, "We're going to fight." And fight they have, and they have been remarkably resilient.
What are we, 3 years effort. Into this?
Almost. Well, we're over two. They've been remarkably resilient. They continue to fight, but they've had a rough stretch here in the last little bit. And to join us now, and we so enjoy, retired Colonel Jeff McCausland, who's a CBS military analyst, and he joins us here on the celebrity guest line of the Voice of St. Louis. Colonel McCausland, welcome aboard.
Great to be with you guys, and I'm a very iconic spot for this conversation. Believe it or not, I'm sitting aboard the battleship USS Iowa here in the harbor in San Pedro, California, getting ready to run a workshop focused on the attack on Pearl Harbor. So having this discussion about D-Day sitting here on a battleship is pretty special.
Wow.
Well, let's start there with D-Day. Let's talk about just the logistics of putting that assault together, multiple nations involved. The planning. We lost a number of troops just in the preparation for D-Day, let alone the day itself. Talk about the logistical planning that had to take place to pull that off.
Well, logistical planning was massive. This operation, beginning of planning, had begun even a year or so prior to the actual invasion on the 6th of June, 1944. You know, Omar Bradley, who's one of Eisenhower's subordinates, used to frequently say strategy and tactics is for amateurs and logistics and sustainment is for professionals. And that was all about the massive amount of men, materiel, aircraft, ships, ammunition, food, fuel, etc. We're building a temporary dock in the Gaza Strip right now. Well, guess what? They towed temporary docks in 1944 across the channel called Mulberries to allow them to disembark ships right there on the beaches in the days after the initial invasion. And sadly, you're quite right. A number of soldiers were killed in training exercises prior to the invasion where they were practicing how to do mass landings ashore, coming from the sea, airborne assaults, and soldiers were killed and injured in that process. But, you know, it showed the one thing about the United States during that particular conflict, and also that is the massive capacity of our industrial base and the massive resilience. Again, here I'm aboard a battleship. We're talking about Pearl Harbor. Well, one of the battleships that was damaged very severely at the attack on Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December, 1941, was the USS Nevada, which was hit by seven torpedoes. And 6th of June, 1944, the battleship Nevada is in the English Channel pounding German targets on the shore there at Normandy because our industrial base had repaired the ship, got it back underway, and sails all the way from the Pacific to the Atlantic to be part of the invasion.
That's remarkable. And I read something yesterday that all the material that they brought, the military stuff, they also brought 30,000 cots to deal with the dead and wounded that they were expecting. And then you think about being an 18, 19-year-old soldier and you're embarking on this thing, and there's 30,000 cots because they're expecting that many people to be killed or wounded. That had to be, for those individual soldiers, just an excruciatingly difficult moment, and yet they pulled it off.
Exactly right, and it's a credit to all those young guys. You know, I was talking with a veteran who's still living. He's 102. He was 22 years of age. He was a PFC in the 82nd Airborne, who bailed into Normandy there on the 6th of June in the early morning hours. And you can just imagine, here you are in an aircraft, which is flying fairly slowly, a Dakota, coming across from England under intense anti-aircraft fire. You're looking out the window, you're seeing certain planes get hit and go down. Or even worse, you're not going to parachute in. You're going to ride in a glider, because we had all these gliders tied to the back end of these Dakotas. And you're going to ride in this glider that's made out of plywood to land in the marshes of Normandy. And sadly, many, many guys were killed before they even got into the fight, because they died when the aircraft went down. They died in crashes with the gliders.
And yesterday, Colonel, we had the honoring at Normandy, France, the 80th anniversary. President Biden was there, President Macron. Most of the European allies were all there. There was one noticeably absent one, for obvious reasons, and one new one present. Of course, Vladimir Zelensky was there. But Russia, who lost the most people in the liberation, was not there because of their unjust war right now.
That's exactly right. And so this becomes not only a commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day, but to some degree a somber moment. Whereas many said, and I think President Biden certainly said this, the freedom and democracy in Europe, if not around the world, is threatened in a greater way than any time since those paratroopers landed, the soldiers went ashore, or Rangers scaled the cliff at Pointe du Hoc, which is what I believe he's going to speak today.
Yeah. Let's take a little snapshot at Ukraine right now. We know they've suffered some territorial losses in these intervening months while Congress was unable to act. Now the U.S. aid has gone forward. The U.S. policy has continued to evolve here. Originally, we weren't going to send any planes. Well, now we're sending planes, training pilots. I don't know if they've been deployed. We weren't authorizing the use of our weapons into Russia. We've now authorized that, to take out some of the Russian launch capacity where they've just been bombing the snot out of Kharkiv. Where do things stand on the ground now in Ukraine?
Well, they stand on the ground at near stalemate, with the Russians having somewhat of the initiative. You're quite right, because of shortages, particularly of air defense weapons and artillery, the Russians have made some fairly modest gains in and around Kharkiv and down in the south. I think they've taken a couple hundred square kilometers over the last few months, but we're starting to see that artillery ammunition arrive. We're starting to see the air defense arrive. The F-16 aircraft, the initial F-16 aircraft, is my understanding, will arrive in Ukraine sometime in the next month or so. That'll make a big difference. But this controversy we had here briefly on whether or not the Ukrainians could use American weapons to strike targets in Russia, I always found a bit silly. I mean, the Charter of the United Nations allows for a country to defend itself against attack. And for us to argue to the Ukrainians, well, the Russians can shoot at you from Russian territory, but you can't shoot back because we're using our weapons, I found almost silly, frankly. But that seems to be cleared up now, because it's basically what we call in the artillery, where I spend my career, counterfire. You know, you want to identify that launcher before it begins to fire, and you can do that and hit it and cause them to have to move their man and material around. You want to prevent them from being able to mass, logistics, manpower, et cetera, for a major attack, so you don't want to provide them sanctuaries. And finally, the Russians were using these glide bombs, so invariably what they were doing was having Russian aircraft loiter over Ukrainian air or over Russian airspace and launch the glide bombs from there to strike targets in and around Kharkiv, and again, the Ukrainians were precluded from shooting at them.
Yeah, it's just you're right. That doesn't make any sense. Before we let you go, we got about a minute left. The long-term, you know, prognosticate for us, the long-term resolution of this conflict.
The long-term resolution, I think, will be at least into 2025. Vladimir Putin firmly believes at this point, and perhaps he has to, because this may have well become existential for him personally. He has to be successful to personally survive. And so he's betting on his willpower is far superior to ours. frankly, he's betting on the election in the United States in November of this year, and he believes, and the choice is pretty clear, I think. Mr. Biden reiterated, I think, his position that the United States would stand behind Ukraine to see it defended to the very end. And Mr. Trump has been pretty outspoken that if he is elected, he will end aid to Ukraine, and that pretty much may compromise the Ukrainians' ability to survive. And frankly, I think could wield a death blow to NATO, which is really Mr. Putin's ultimate objective. His ultimate objective is to destroy NATO. That's what he really wants to do. And this operation Ukraine just becomes a vehicle to, in fact, do that. So he's going to stick with us until the fall. I think we have not seen the cracks in the Russian economy that we expected early on in this conflict. But my read is that while the economy of Russia seems on the surface to be doing well and growing, a lot of that growth is really because they're expanding so much their industrial capacity for defense. And long term, that's not a recipe for a healthy economy. And they're still running at 8 or 10% inflation and getting ready to raise taxes to 22% to pay for this conflict.
You see there, you're getting smarter just listening to the man. He is Colonel Jeff McCausland. Colonel, thank you for what you did for our country, and thanks for taking a couple of moments to spend time with us here on KMOX.
Always a great pleasure, guys.